Very good. Rabbi Chedzis, as you can probably hear, he spent 2 years in Toronto, right? 2 years as the assistant rabbi at Sheir Shemaim Congregation, large, for in many ways, the largest Orthodox synagogue in the Toronto, maybe in Canada. And now he's the rabbi of the Young Israel in Sharon, which is, I don't know if, what part of Boston you grew up in. I assume not in Sharon, or you grew up in Sharon.
I grew up in Newton.
You grew up in Newton. So I've never been there. I've been to Boston itself in Maimonides, where you went to school, but I haven't been out in the suburbs of Boston. And I see you were the grounds crew at Fenway Park. Oh my gosh. Wow.
I used to be talking famous.
Baseball before. Baseball has come up in a few of them. Anyways, I don't want to take away any more time. A pleasure to welcome you. Vakasha.
Okay. Thank you so much, Rabbi Kelman. It's great to reconnect, and thank you for the invitation to share some Torah. My wife and I had such a delightful time while we were in Toronto, including some teaching for Torah in Motion. And we were always so impressed by the substance and the relevance of the classes and the programming. So it's good to sort of, in a way, be back. also good to reconnect with Rabbi Kelman. I'm going to be going to Camp Stone this summer, so maybe I'll see another one of your kids. It was great to spend overlap with them.
First or second session. All right. So my son's going to be in Machal that he missed last year, the first 2 weeks.
Okay.
And then I have another son coming second session, but Alicia was Rosh Marsh the last 2 years. That's it. He graduated from Camp Stone.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm a lifer, so we're coming back to teach a bit, and I'll probably be seeing him because I'm also going to be doing the coveted position of being a nahag, of being a driver to coordinate some stuff with Machal and some of the trips. Anyways, I will stop with the insider, talk here, and begin some of the contents for this evening. So over the last year, I have been teaching the drashot of Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb for my weekly Parsha class here in Boston. And we usually take a look at a few of the sources that he quotes, and then we read through parts of his drasha. As you might know, Rabbi Lamb was a remarkable darshan, an incredible orator, a really gifted mind in blending together wisdom from the Parsha, current events, and timeless lessons. And so it's been a wonderful experience for me to teach and for the members here to learn. And so this evening, I'm going to be sharing one of his drashot from his collection, Drashot Lidorot, which is a compilation of his sermons on each of the five books of the Chumash. And just as some general background, Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb, his first yahrzeit was actually just 2 weeks ago. And he started his rabbinic career here in Massachusetts, where he was the rabbi of Kadima in Springfield. And then he was recruited to go to the Jewish Center and then to Yeshiva University, where he served as president and chancellor for decades. Really a man who rescued and stabilized the yeshiva. And I had many occasions to learn from him directly when he gave shiurim while I was there as a student, and also to converse with him in his office. And he even signed my smicha klaf. I can give you a little bit of a tour of my office. I don't know if you can see, but that's my smicha klaf from Yeshiva University right there. I was privileged to have Rabbi Lamb sign my smicha klaf. Did he sign yours as well, Rabbi Kelman? Yes, okay. So it's...
I was there in the early years of his presidency. You were there in the later years of his presidency.
Tail end, yeah. It's really a badge of honor to have his name on my smicha. And he was really a visionary, an ideologue, an incredible, charismatic leader for decades. And so we miss his presence. In his absence, we continue to learn and share his Torah. So I think you posted the sources in the chat, but I think I'll also share screen. Is that a good idea? Okay, that's typically what I do. So let's share screen here. See if I can pull up the sources. It should be right here. Okay. Thumbs up if you can see those sources. Okay, great. Nice, by the way, to see some familiar names. I definitely recognize some of the last names here from my time in Toronto. So it's good to reconnect. And in general, my style, my comfort zone is interactive. I know it can be a little bit challenging over Zoom to feel comfortable speaking up. But if you're so inclined, I would welcome comments. Certainly if they are in keeping with the flow of the content, whether they're clarifying questions or probing questions, please don't hesitate. So the topic for our time together is, does it pay to be good? This was the title of a drasha that Rabbi Lamb gave. He was already at the Jewish Center in 1972 when he gave this drasha. So I'll read a bit from the beginning of his words here, and then we're going to take a look at some of the source material that he is based upon, and we'll go back and forth between the two. Does it pay to be good? This is a question one often hears and asks as a sign of frustration. Usually it is just an expression of momentary disappointment and serves a cathartic function, right? So I relate to this after a long, hard day. Sometimes I will look in the mirror or talk to my wife and say, does it pay to be a good person? Because X, Y, and Z happened, right? There are so many examples to choose from times where we make our best effort to do good, and then we feel frustrated. And we sort of pose that question rhetorically about, does it pay to be good? I'll just give one example to flush out this kind of scenario. There was a family in our community with a child who was going through a procedure, and the Chesed committee stepped up and offered to make meals for this family for 2 weeks. And people participated, and it was really a wonderful effort. After the 2 weeks were over, I get a call from the mother of this family, and she says, Rabbi, I am really upset. I had to throw out all of the food because we are allergic to all sorts of things. Why didn't you tell the Chesed committee? They should have known, right? And I was a little baffled that this miscommunication happened and that it kept going for 2 weeks. And of course, I was in a very uncomfortable position, but this was one of those instances where I ask myself, does it pay to be good, right? We try and we put forth an effort and it doesn't always pay off. The good is not always received as it was intended. So that's, I think, typically how we offer this question of, does it pay to be good? But sometimes, Rabbi Lamb continues, and with some people, and especially if repeated often enough, it is elevated from a query of complaint to a philosophy of life, from a passing mood to a firm moral judgment. So let us ask ourselves the question rather seriously, does it pay to be good? Okay, so Rabbi Lamb wants to move away from this question as a throwaway or as a complaint or as a dismissal of an unjust or just unkind world. And he invites us to ask this question from a philosophical standpoint, which is often his style. He opens up with a large question, an enduring human question, right? And so here in this drasha, it is no different. He invites us to ask the question about whether or not it is worth it to be good or not. So in a good, brisker way, he dissects the question and puts it, divides it into two parts. You can follow along here. He says, we must first divide the question into two parts by posing a counter question. Pay for whom? Does it pay to be good? May refer to the benefactor, right, to the one doing the good, the one asking the question, or it may refer to the beneficiary, the one who is the recipient of my goodness and generosity. The first question, does it pay for me to be good, probably should be answers for most cases in the negative. If you expect dividends from your ethical investments, you are seriously in error. The good life is not necessarily the happy life. John Kennedy, born into a very wealthy family, high society, catapulted into historic political prominence, decided that life is unfair. This was from a speech a famous speech that JFK gave after he was criticized for sending troops into Vietnam. And he justifies his decision by stating that some men are killed in war, some men are wounded, some men never leave the country, some men are stationed in Antarctic, and some in San Francisco. It's very hard in military or in personal life to assure complete equality. Life is unfair, right? So just a sort of a reference that Rabbi Lamb makes to his own times, but one that we certainly can appreciate on our empirical level as well, life doesn't work out in a way that we observe to be fair. Just this past Sunday, we took my son to Barnes & Noble's, a big bookstore here, and he got a gift certificate for his birthday. And we were buying him some stuff, and it turned out that the bill was $4 above the amount that he had in the gift card. So we paid it. And of course, our daughter, who was closest in age to him, launched into a tirade that when it was her birthday, we made her keep to the exact amount on the gift certificate and said, you can't go over. So the drive home was like World War III. And we had to negotiate with our daughter. And it was not a simple task to walk her off the ledge from her accusation of life not being fair. But as we know from being parents and from just experiencing life, things are not fair, right? And so if we do good and we send good out into the world, we don't always see it manifest. It doesn't always land in the way that we wanted to, in the way that we intended it to. And Chazal, of course, understood that. Rabbi Lamb cites the Gemara in Kiddushin that much earlier, the rabbis broadly conclude that the reward for virtue simply is not evidence in this world. Right here, they are alluding to Olam Haba, where the scales balance out, where the system of schar va'onesh, of reward and punishment, works itself out in a way that we certainly don't experience in this world. So that is the first question that Rabbi Lam offers and answers in terms of this meta question of, does it pay to be good? And the answer is no, it usually does not, but we shouldn't expect it to, because that's not how the world was engineered, how it was structured, how it was set up. But essentially, the question does not even deserve an answer. Continuing along here, for no matter what the answer may be, our immediate reaction must be to ask, so what? Who says that it has to pay in the first place? An individual who plans to be moral because it pays to be good will either end up evil or will suffer constant frustration. Okay, so let's think about that for a second. Why will a person who expects or who is moral because of the reward end up evil? Perhaps because they will discover that there is no immediate reward and punishment. So they might as well cause all the harm possible and get away with it, right? Or they will become continuously frustrated. They might not become evil, but they will just grow fatigued with the lack of cause and effect behind their action and the world. So Judaism taught us, do not be like servants who serve the master only in order to receive a salary or a wage. Don't be good merely because it pays. Judaism never urged upon us that old maxim, honesty is the best policy. A Jew must be honest even when it is not a good policy. Morals and goodness are matters of principle, not prudence. I just envision, or I can hear Rabbi Lam's voice and his cadence saying these words. He's, you know, just to reflect for a second on the beauty of this language and this diction, which is so rich and so advanced, right? Morals and goodness are matters of principle, not prudence. These lines are quotable. They could be on magnets, on our fridges, right? Yes, we believe that ultimately there is spiritual reward, but this must never become the motive for being good in the first place, right? He is saying here that our motivation for being good must not be because it pays. We are good for good's sake or for God's sake, but not because of the reward, because more often than not, we won't ever see the reward. And so that motive will run dry very quickly. Okay, so that is the first part of the question. Does it pay to be good? Does it pay for me, the giver, to embark on the good? And his answer is it does not pay, but it's still the right thing, and it's still what we must do. The real question that is worth pondering is the second question. Does it pay to be good for the beneficiary of my kindness? At first glance, it is a simple matter of definition. Obviously, it is good for someone if I do that person good. Yet, it is not quite that simple. We must consider such factors as excess, timing, short-term indulgence, which may lead to long-term damage. And here, there can be no uniform answer, right? The example that I gave a few moments ago of the family in need whose meals were made for them, but not tending to the allergies of the family, right? That was good that was not beneficiary, that was not benefiting the recipient, right? Because There were several other factors that got in the way between the giver and the receiver. So here, what is required, Rabbi Lamb says, in order to try and connect the dots between the giver and the receiver, is wisdom and maturity and deliberation in order to foretell whether our benefaction will ultimately prove helpful or harmful, right? So the experience that we had with this family taught us to always ask before setting up a meal train, do you have any allergies? Usually we ask, and maybe the question was asked and it wasn't answered, but now we're going to be a lot more diligent in asking. Our chesed committee will be a lot more diligent in asking that question, because that's learning from our experience. And that can make all the difference whether the good will prove to be helpful or harmful. Okay, so Ad Kan, until this point, we have set up an intellectual framework about the question of goodness and whether there is reward for goodness in this world, whether it pays for the giver and for the receiver. And we've problematized each of those in a sophisticated way. I hope at this point you are all wondering, I thought this was a Parsha Shir. What does this have to do with Parshat Shlach? What is the connection here to the central episode of the Meraglim, of the spies in the Parsha? Anyone want to take a guess or speculate how this framing might map onto that episode? Okay, well, it is certainly not an obvious connection. So I am not surprised at the quiet, but I am going to try and take us step by step to the point in which we can appreciate this framework as casting a new lens on the story of the spies. And Rabbi Lamb uses the story of the spies as an illustration of a case where it did not pay to be good. We're going to examine some of the sources inside and build towards that. Let's begin with the second source, which is the beginning of our parsha, Parshat Shlach Lecha. And I will read and translate. And the question that I want you to keep in mind as we read through this source and subsequent ones, which will eventually lead us back to that question of does it pay to be good, is as follows. Who is the responsible party for the colossal sin of the spies? Okay, so with that specific question in mind, we read Shlach Lecha Anashim, you should send for yourself men, right? These are considered to be men of great stature. They are the Nesi'im, the princes of each tribe, Vayaturu et Eretz Kana'an, right? This word Vayaturu is a very rich one. It hyperlinks to the Parsha, at the Parshia, the section at the end of the Parsha of Tzitzit, where we see Velo Taturu, Acharei Lavchanim, you should not follow your after your eyes. So there's a linguistic connection there. So here Hashem is saying to Moshe, you should send men of stature to tour, to scout out the land of Canaan, Asher ani noten livnei Yisrael, that I am giving, right? Regardless of what happens to the Jewish people, it's theirs. It was promised to Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Ish echad lamate avotav tishlachu, tish kol nasi bahem. So one per shevet is the way that they will be appointed and gathered together for this mission. So coming back to the question that I asked you about who is the responsible party, what are the options that we have based on this first verse? Our options are, I would say, three. The first option is that Hashem seems to give a command to send spies, right? That is the starting point. And therefore, it would seem to fall on Hashem that this was a bad idea and that Hashem should not have commanded Moshe to go ahead with this mission. The second option is Moshe. And Hashem might be pinning this decision on Moshe if we look at the language of Shlach Lecha, which we will soon see how Rashi develops specifically the phrase send for yourself to indicate that Moshe made the error in judgment here. The third option, before we go deeper into that second option, is that it was the spies who offered opinion rather than fact, to use sort of a summary of Nechama Leibowitz's take on the story. It was the spies who abused their role, and the fault lies with them. So those are the three options, and I want to drill a little bit deeper into the second option, that the blame lies with Moshe. So Rashi cites the Midrash from Tanchuma in source number 3, where he says that the blame lies with Moshe. Shlach Lecha, Rashi says, I'll read in the Hebrew and translate. You can also follow along on the left side in the English, which means according to your judgment, Moshe, you should send according to your discerning eye. Ani eini mitzaveh lecha. I am not commanding you to do so. This directive is not coming from me, from Hashem. Im tirtzeh shlach. If you want to send, you should do so for your own sake. Lefi shebao Yisrael ve'amru, because the Jewish people came and said, nishlacha anashim lefaneinu. They said, we want to send people before us. Kemash ne'amar v'tikrevun alai kulchem, alai kulchem. As Moshe reported that they gathered upon me and surrounded me to make this request. Umoshe nimlach b'shchina, and then Moshe took counsel with Hashem. Amar, amarti lahem shehi tova. Whereupon Hashem said, I have told them long ago that this land is good, right? Shehi tova, not referring to the decision or the opportunity to send spies, but rather that the land is definitively good. Shne'emar eletchem me'oni Mitzrayim, as Hashem said earlier, that he will take the Jewish people up from the poverty, from the suffering of Mitzrayim, and take them to a good place of Eretz Chalav u'Dvash, land flowing with milk and honey. So chayehem sha'ani noten lahem makom lit'ot b'divrei meraglim lama'an lo yershuha. So he says, I swear that I will give them an opportunity to fall into error through the statements made of the spies, so that they shouldn't come into possession of it because they were not trusting of the fact that I said the land was good for them and they should just go and get it. So this midrash totally turns the phrase shlach lecha from being about Hashem endorsing this mission to Hashem being very skeptical, if not dismissive or discouraging of this mission. And instead placing the responsibility on Moshe, who is in the driver's seat of this mission, and saying, you should go ahead with it only if you want to, but it is going to be on you if it goes south. Okay. So from these initial sources, we see that it seems that Moshe is the one to blame. Perhaps it could be that the Jewish people get something wrong for insisting on sending spies, and perhaps it could be that the spies themselves were a corrupting influence. They abused their position as presidents of their tribes. But what's fascinating is the way that this episode, that this narrative is recapitulated, is retold and revisited in Moshe's soliloquy in Parshat Devarim. Really, throughout all of Sefer Devarim, Moshe is up on a soapbox of sorts, preaching and giving some criticism and inspiration to the Jewish people as his life is coming to a close. And when Moshe retells the story of the Meraglim, he tells it in such a way that gives us new insight into who is the responsible party. And this is going to start bringing us back to where we departed from in terms of that question of, does it pay to be good? Because we're going to see here that Moshe seems to indicate that the decision to send the spies was good for him. So what does that mean? So let's look at the context of Moshe's description of this episode upon reflection. And let's try and appreciate what the good was in this decision, because we know that it was a colossal failure. So let's read in the first parak of Devarim, source number 4. Va'omar aleichem batem ad har ha'emori, asher Hashem Elokeinu notein lanu. So Moshe is saying that you have come to the place where the Shiva Ta'amimim, the seven nations, occupy, where Eretz Yisrael is, will be, the land which Hashem will give to you. Re'e Natan Hashem Elokecha lefanecha ta'aretz. And Moshe is saying, I said to you at that juncture, at that time, look in front of you and see this beautiful land. Alei Reish, go up and conquer it. Kasher diber Hashem Elokei avotecha lach, al tira ve'al techat, like Hashem had said to your forefathers, don't fear, don't be afraid, don't be intimidated, just go and get it. I will be with you. I will deliver them into your hands. Right, all of the Kana'anim, all of the Shivata Amim will be delivered into their hands. That's what Hashem promises the Jewish people. But nevertheless, Vatikrivun Elai Kulchem, you gathered around me, Vitamru, and you said, Nishalcha Anashim Lefaneinu, let us send spies before us, Vaychapru Lanu Ata'aretz, that they can scout out the land. V'yashivu otanu davar, and they will return a report to us. Et haderach asher na'aleba, they will collect military intelligence so that we have the best route to go. V'yata arim, they will sort of get a report on the cities and how to best attack them. Asher navo alehen, and how we can go up and get the land. V'yitav be'enai hadavar, and the matter was good to me. Ve'ekach mikem shneim asar anashim ish achad la'shevet. And so I subsequently went ahead and chose 12 men, one from each tribe, to serve this function of scouting out the land. So here is where I want to press pause and delve a little bit deeper into these words, Vayitav be'enei hadavar. What does it mean that Moshe says this matter was good for me? The translation here is I approved of the plan. But I think a more precise translation is that this plan was good for me. Let's play it out. Why was this plan good for Moshe? Hashem had already promised to deliver the inhabitants of the land into the hands of the Jewish people. Why wait? Why risk that immediate conquest after leaving Egypt, go straight to the land of Israel? Why send the spies? It was just a rolling of the dice. Moshe had so much to lose. So what about this was good for Moshe? So perhaps what was good for Moshe was that he would be able to get the people off his back. We know that Moshe at this point in his career was exasperated. He was overwhelmed by the neediness of the Jewish people, and he was in survival mode. The complaint after complaint after complaint made him weary, and he might have wanted to just give in to the people to get them off his case. So in the very short term here, this was good for Moshe by giving in to them because they stopped complaining at that moment and they said, okay, good. You're giving in to our request. We have something to do. The situation de-escalated. They stopped yelling at Moshe to send spies. But that was a short-term gain, which led to a long-term loss. And here we will start to return to our point of departure, which is about how to ensure that our good pays off for the recipient. And oftentimes, as we saw Rabbi Lamb saying, it takes wisdom and discernment to be able to ensure that goodness lands in the way that it was intended. I see that I might have frozen for a second. I hope everyone is still with me. You give me a nod or a thumbs up if you can hear me.
I don't think you froze, not on my end.
Okay.
For maybe a tenth of a second, but nothing that we didn't miss any word.
Okay, we'll blame it on the border security. Okay. So now I want to return back to the words of Rabbi Lamb, who suggests that indeed, we'll skip a few of these sources, maybe we'll come back to them if we have time. But Rabbi Lamb now casts this question of, does it pay to be good, on the goodness that Moshe uses to describe the decision to send the spies, and posits that the goodness was a very short-term kind of goodness that was lacking in prudence and in discernment. So Rabbi Lam continues, you can follow along with me. The incident of Moshe and the spies he sent into Canaan provides an illustration of a case where it did not pay to be good. Hashem told Moshe, send for yourself people to spy out the land of Canaan. But according to the way the rabbis, as cited by Rashi that we just read inside, interpreted the incident, the relations between God, Israel, and Moshe were quite complex. And the role of Moshe was anomalous. I actually had to look up that word, anomalous. It didn't come to me immediately that it was a form of the word anomaly, right? Which just means a deviation from sort of standard. But Rabbi Lam had incredible diction. And as we've seen already, he just had such a command over the English language and used it almost in a poetic way to convey meaning in with such beauty and such specificity. It's such a pleasure to read his drashot. I benefited from hearing him deliver, you know, many. And one of the themes that came up in his in the eulogies for him, I remember Dr. David Schatz spoke about this specifically, is how he would come every week to the Jewish Center just to hear Rabbi Lam teach. And it was like a performance almost that was dazzling. He would teach and he would preach from the pulpit for 25 minutes. And everyone was enthralled and sitting at the edge of their seats, grasping onto every word. Rabbi Lam sort of set the standard for pulpit rabbis giving drashot. And no longer can rabbis get away with a 25-minute drasha. Since the pandemic and since we've been back in shul, I can barely get away with a 5-minute drasha. As we've streamlined davening and people have much less patience. So putting that aside for a moment, Rabbi Lam here is saying that when Hashem told Moshe, send for yourself, Hashem is saying, this is not what I want, but you can do it only if you want it, right? Passing the responsibility on to Moshe. In other words, the sending of the spies was a concession. Like the permission to appoint a king over themselves, or the granting of permission for the eating of meat to the children of Noah, or the law of the beautiful captive, right? Those are all things that we're familiar with, which several of the medieval commentators explain to be sort of a concession to human nature. Each one of these is an example that deserves examination in its own right, but we can sort of add the spies to that list of things that, you know, were that God said do, but it was not out of a ideal sort of sense. Rather, it was giving into human nature and sort of conceding to the limits of humanity. And while we may be grateful to God for being an understanding father, it is not always clear that such indulgence is for our ultimate good. Obviously, here, Moshe was being too good. He submitted to the pressure by the Israelites when perhaps he should not have done so. He was too good, and it didn't pay. So what should Moshe have done? He should have said no. He should have said, we don't need spies. We know that we have a guarantee to conquer the land, and we don't need to jeopardize any of that by going on this scouting mission. Just imagine if Moshe had said no to that group of people who surrounded him demanding that they send spies. Jewish history would have turned out different. Moshe would have been able to enter the land. And this whole episode of the spies, would not have resulted in 40 years of wandering in the desert. And We could even say that there wouldn't even be a minyan, a requirement for a minyan, because we know that the source for requiring 10 men to make a minyan is from the Edah, from the 10 spies consort together. So indeed, things would have been very different if Moshe had said no to this request. But he didn't. He said yes. He was being too soft on the people, and it didn't pay. So continuing here in Rabbi Lamb's words, the commentators are undecided about the moral qualities of the spies. Some say they were truly just. Some say merely innocent. And some say they were wicked. But I prefer a fourth interpretation, now the Midrash Tanchuma, which declares them kisilim, a word which means both knaves and fools, primarily the latter. The spies were immature and childish, and Moshe overindulged them, pampered them, and babied them like a father who is too good to his little children. Right? Sometimes we think it's hard to imagine Moshe pampering the leaders, but indeed, it is possible, and that is what happened. He gave in to them because it was easier to give in to them than to hold the line and to do what was necessary, what was right, and sort of a tough love kind of no, because Moshe knew that the alternative would be a faster and safer route into the land of Israel. So in Deuteronomy 1:23, and here we're going to get to the most recent source that we saw inside of Moshe recollecting the story of the spies. He says, Vayitav be'enei hadavar, which usually is explained as the plan found favor in my eyes. But if Moshe admitted that the plan was valid in his own opinion, how does Rashi tell us here that Moshe did not really favor it and that he consulted with a divine presence which discouraged him? Right, the Rashi that we saw and the Rashi which we didn't see on this pasuk say the same thing, which is that Moshe asked Hashem for advice. Hashem gave him clear advice that it's not a good idea, and yet Moshe went ahead and did it anyways. So Rabbi Lamb says, I submit that perhaps the expression of Vayitav be'enei hadavar means in essence that I, Moshe, considered the matter and decided to be good to you meaning to the Jewish people who were making this demand. And of course, Moshe erred, for to be good is not always the same as to do good. It is sometimes better to be hard-headed than soft-hearted. What a beautiful line. I'm going to read that one more time. As a parent, this really is important advice that I need to give myself. It is sometimes better to be hard-headed than soft-hearted. So all of us must learn in our personal and professional and especially family lives that it does not always pay to be good. Sometimes we intend to be kind and generous and are only inviting trouble later on for the very one whom out of love we seek to benefit. Right? When we don't have boundaries with our children, we don't set limits, then they don't understand how to navigate relationships with other people and to form proper boundaries and limitations themselves. When Moshe fails to set the boundary and to say no to the Jewish people, they indulge in something that feels good in the moment, and it really backfires big time. Continuing along here, we tend to sin in this respect, especially as parents. It is an old Jewish syndrome of which the Bible records numerous examples, right? Eli with his sons, Shmuel with his sons, David with his sons. And in our days, we often try to give our children what we did not have. And so we fail to give them what we did have. What a beautiful insight, right? That we often try to give our children what we did not have. And so we fail to give them what we did have. Our generation of affluent is overpressing material good on the younger generation, and thereby denying them a sense of discovery, of self-worth, of the achievement of earning and deserving the goods of the world. We think, Vayitav Be'enei Hadavar, we're being so good to them. We're making their lives, you know, so pleasurable and so easy. But is it really good for them? It might feel good in the short term, but in the long term, there are significant consequences. But this idea of short-term kindness leading to eventual harm has not only to do with individuals, but applies to collectives as well. And here, Rabbi Lam is about to launch into current day affairs, at least in the 1970s, and Ein Chadash Tachat HaShemesh, there is nothing new under the sun, as we will be able to relate to the sentiment in our time as well. He says, one such case is the problem of the priorities that our liberal Jewish community sets for itself. We are generally a kindly people and therefore concerned with the well-being of all peoples, and that is as it should be. But we have sinned in the area of priorities. We have tried to be good to others and denied our kindness from our own kin. We have acted politically, socially, and economically on behalf of all the underprivileged, except for the Jewish poor. On behalf of all political causes, except our own. On behalf of all marginal people, except for those of our own people who have not yet made it. And so it did not pay for us, for them to be good. It did not pay for us or for them to be good. Right? So certainly this is something, this sentiment of our sort of our collective, does it pay to be good? And Rabbi Lam is criticizing the progressive liberal community for sometimes siding with the underprivileged outside the Jewish community in place of the underprivileged in the Jewish community, right? And certainly we have witnessed and experienced this quite painfully in the recent flare-up in Israel with Hamas, when saw many voices in the progressive camp that was siding with the Palestinians, which is, you know, philosophically defensible, but it just means that we're not a family if every Jew and every Arab are exactly on the same level and there is no familial preference given to family over other, right? So it's a little bit of a rant, a little bit of a digression, but I think it needs to be stated, as sometimes our progressive values undermine our core identity. So to summarize, we respond to the question, does it pay to be good, as follows. If the question is asked whether it pays for me to do good, the question is invalid. It is a pseudo question because it really makes no difference what the answer is. It is irrelevant. I do not do good because it pays, but because I am a Jew, I am commanded to do good. But if it means, does it pay to be good towards the beneficiary? The answer is that it depends upon the individual, upon his maturity and sense of proportion, upon that person's absorptive capacity for kindness and goodness. It is a question which demands wisdom and knowledge of the particular case in order to know how to act properly. And indeed, the central narrative of Parshat Shlach is a illustration of it not paying to be good when that effort to do good to the other is made with a sense of expediency and convenience, as opposed to one of long-term and core values. And that's the trap that Moshe falls into. And this is a little bit critical of Moshe. And indeed, Moshe, of course, carried Jewish history on his shoulders, and not all of us are in that position to derail history by taking the easy route, and, you know, placating people instead of demanding something from them. But all of us are in a position to affect the relationships that we do have with our family, our friends, by being more thoughtful about how we try to achieve goodness in our midst. I'm going to close there and allow for a few minutes for conversation, questions. I have not been monitoring the chat, but I would love to do so. I'll stop sharing and invite anyone that would like to speak up to please do so. And I'll also...
A couple of comments in the chat if you wanted to take a look.
Okay. Okay, a good insight someone offered about paying more for ethically produced goods because it makes us feel good, even if we're not actually affecting good. I see a question. Meraglim thought they were doing B'nai Israel a favor by telling them the truth. Maybe that was a suggestion for how to connect the dots between.
That's what I was doing. I took a guess, and I guessed too far ahead in the story.
but I like that that suggestion, and I think we could forecast it forward as well, in terms of the spies thinking that they were doing good by protecting the Jewish people from defeat of attacking an enemy that would be overbearing and overpowering. But again, that was ignoring the ultimate good of the promise that Hashem had given them, that they would succeed. And the irony is, we read in the Haftorah about how the Kanaanim were actually afraid of the Jewish people. When Yehoshua sends the spies to, when the eventual conquest happens, he learns from Rahab that the Kanaanim are fearful of the Jewish people. But the spies in our story are afraid of the residents of Canaan. And so they share that opinion with the Jewish people, and that sort of sways them from the place where they should be. Okay, let's go down to the next comment. Perhaps one could play devil's advocate and say this generation was not ready, and even if they had not sent the spies, something else would have prevented their reaching the land. Their lack of trust was not necessarily Moshe's problem. So indeed, the commentaries say that even though the Jewish people left Egypt, Egypt never left the Jewish people. The Torah says that, but on a psychological level, the commentators use that as a thread that to weave through all of the complaints. And the story of the spies indicates that they were spiritually immature and unready to actually take the leap into a autonomous existence in Eretz Yisrael. The dependency of the desert was too comfortable and too easy for them. It was so similar to the dependency they had on their taskmasters in Egypt, and they couldn't break that dynamic. So maybe it was more their problem, their lack of trust, than it was Moshe's.
Right. I was responding to your comment where you were saying that it was that Moshe here, was being soft on them, and it was because of Moshe that they didn't go in, that he.
Oh. Okay. So you're suggesting that it had less to do with Moshe and more to do with their distrusting nature.
Right. That they just weren't up to it. This generation just couldn't hack it. It wasn't Moshe's problem. Moshe has just said to them that it's good and it's going to be good and it's great and it's phenomenal. He was on that high in Perek Yud. And here, even if you had said if they hadn't sent the spies, you know, they would have ended up there, everything would have been fine. If they hadn't sent the spies, I feel it would have been something else.
Yeah.
You know,
their track record was not a good one until this point. So it's a great point, right, Debbie. I was sort of just having fun with the possibility of rewriting, you know, history. But indeed, their, you know, their stiff-necked nature might have manifested, you know, differently even if this mission hadn't been sent.
Right. That's my feeling. Right.
Yeah. And I also see a last comment from Stephen. Is there any issue with saying Moshe should have not indulged the people's short-term interests when Hashem was himself good to Moshe and authorizing the spies under similar conditions? Couldn't Moshe and Hashem be following Hashem's model? Yeah, the text is very ambiguous, right? And that's why we tried to sort of delineate the three possible sort of addresses for blame in this story. Hashem could have said to Moshe, don't do it, right? Instead, he says, go ahead with it if you want it, right? Which is not definitive enough for Moshe. And so indeed, Moshe could just be sort of following Hashem's command to go ahead with it. At least on a pshat level, I think that is a very compelling read. Okay. Well, thank you for those insights. I also got a lot of private messages, which I appreciate. Thank you again for joining and for learning Torah together. It's really a delight. And I wish everyone a Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you very much, Rabbi. Thank you. A pleasure. Next week, Rabbi Yecheskel Freundlich of Tiferet Beth David, Jerusalem, Yerushalayim, in Montreal, TBDJ, will be giving the Parsha Shir. Tomorrow morning, I'll be giving the Perkei Avot Shir at 9:30 a.m. Everybody's welcome. And I was going to announce at the beginning, just a little advance notice. Tuesday, we're going to have a special interview or conversation, my brother, actually, who lives in Israel, who runs the organization Kedma, soon organization, is going to be interviewing Rabbanit Shira Mervis, who was just appointed as the spiritual leader of a congregation in Efrat in Israel. And I'm sure many of you saw the stories in the newspapers. That'll be Tuesday at 1 p.m. You have to register. That does not, even those who registered for all the programs, this is a separate registration. It's on the website. I haven't sent that by email yet. You're the first people hearing about it. So I just wanted to give you advance notice on that. All our regular shirim. Rabbi, you can invite anybody in Boston. This, Sharon's welcome to come. Rabbi Liebtag on Sunday morning, and Rachel Mark Shapiro on Monday night, and Rachel Sharansky Danziger on Tuesday morning. We have a whole series of...
What a lineup.
Keep Simi Peters on Sefer Yirmiyahu, Marty Lakshin on Pshat, Rush, and Halacha. We've got all kinds of good stuff going on. Shuli Miskin, her tours of Israel. So Baruch Hashem. Okay, everybody, we look forward to seeing you either before Shabbos or afterwards. Everybody will. Regards in Sharon. One of these days, maybe I'll get there when we can come across the border. But we can fly in, actually, to the States, you know. We can't drive. They'll stop us at work, but we can fly. It's a sort of funny thing. I don't think you can fly here, though. Like, the border's like tighter getting into Canada than getting into the United States, is my understanding. Mm. But anyways.
Okay. Well, hopefully soon.
You can zoom in. You can zoom in. We get the next best thing, Baruch Hashem, at least we have Zoom, you know. Yeah. So, all right. Regards. And thank you very much. Okay.
All the best.
Call too. Shabbat Shalom.
Bye.